Walking on stage in a spotlight, a pair of black shoes, white socks. Fairy dust sparkles as he kicks. Optimum Productions. Michael Jackson, AM Washington. September 24th, 1976.
This is really true. A lot of people say you just made it up to have something to say. But one day our television broke down and we didn't have anything really to do, like in the morning times. So what we started doing, we started singing. My mother, my brothers, we started making harmony. Next thing we noticed, we were singing in talent shows, winning awards and trophies. And that's how it got started.
Jackson 5, The Ed Sullivan Show, May 10th, 1970.
They want to hear I Want You Back in ABC and the Love You Say.
Right.
The Dancing Machine, the Sugar Daddy, I'll Be There, Got to Be There.
Yeah.
Rock and Robin. You want to hear Daddy's Home? Do you want to hear all the old stuff?
The number one reason I don't want to do the old stuff, number one is old, okay? Number two, the choreography is old. Jackie's old.
Wait a minute,
do you care about that?
Do you care?
I'll tell you what. I'll do the old stuff for you, okay? But I'm doing it for you. I'm not doing it for them. I'm doing it for you.
A montage of the Jackson brothers performing in 1981, 1969, and 1972. They're in matching pea green suits in the 60s and on Soul Train in the 70s. The funky, psychedelic colours of the Jacksons cartoon. Berry Gordy, producer, songwriter, founder, Motown Records.
Their first four songs broke historical records because they all went to number one. The very first four songs they ever recorded, which was I Want You Back,
ABC, For Love You Save,
and I'll Be There.
What happened after that was we went from being able to go anywhere, get a hamburger, go to a movie, you know, go shopping, to being able to go nowhere. They became so successful so quickly that none of us were prepared for it.
Katherine Jackson, mother of the Jackson family.
He used to sing songs with a lot of feeling, and he would sing them with a lot of feeling and a lot of moving, like he had been here before, like he had lived it before.
Vocally, he was just leaps and bounds ahead of what anybody could teach him. He came here knowing that stuff. It was in his DNA.
I discovered that Michael was very talented when he was just about 2 or 3 years old. Michael had a lot of rhythm, and he loved to dance. I think he was born dancing.
Michael told me way back, he said, Steve, I'm not going to be poor. Imagine 11 kids living in a two-bedroom house in Gary, Indiana. And Gary, Indiana is no Beverly Hills.
It was hard. When you have all those kids like I had, and you kids, you know, they like to eat, so when they holler, they want some food, you got to put something in their hand. And I kept food on the table, plenty of food, Spike.
Joseph had done a remarkable job creating the group.
I can remember how much it meant to all of them, but particularly Michael, to make it.
I would say to this day, Motown was the greatest school for me. Really, it was the best. I learned how to cut a track as well as producing. I've learned so many things about writing.
Pretty much like a college that taught us everything about songwriting and producing and everything. And we learned so much about lyrical content, how to produce songs, and just being a great artist. They had the best songwriters and artists in the world.
Here we are in Chicago. You see here members of the Temptations. Down here on the bottom is little Michael with his afro. And I'm right next to him. That's me, y'all.
What Michael learned is to be great, you had to be persistent. You had to You had to work. You got to watch people like Diana Ross, Marvin Gaye, Stevie Wonder.
The Temptations and
Smokey Robinson,
and all those wonderful guys that we idolized.
And these were legends in the music industry that he was able to observe up close, in the studio, in their element.
So I got my degree from Morgetown University.
It was really an atmosphere of competition. Competition breeds champions, but you can't let the competition overcome the love. And so it was all built on love, and Michael was full of love. And the atmosphere just suited him very well.
We learned so much being with all those great songwriters and producers.
And at the time when it's taking place, you don't realize that.
When we were kids ourselves, I didn't know how to do this. And we were learning as we went together.
Suzanne DePass, Jacksonville, Florida, December 30th, 1970. The Jackson 5 rehearsing, then playing for fans. Scott Osborne, ABC News, Jacksonville, Florida, December 30th, 1970.
Yes, it's the same nerve the Beatles touched low these many years ago. Only this time it's a group of black teenagers fretted by an 11-year-old soul brother.
Suzanne DePass, executive in charge of the Jackson 5.
It was so intense, this fan worship. You have to understand that all of the kids who were responding to the Jackson 5 hadn't had a Mickey Mouse Club with kids like them on camera. They represented the first youth group of our contemporary times for all these kids to identify with. And initially, they were all the black kids.
The beginning is, you know, when I first saw him, and that's the reason why I'm here, is that that's what motivated me and wanted me to do whatever it is that I'm doing right now. You know, he's everything that that I aspired to be.
Those boys did practice most of the time because while other kids was out there running the streets and playing, they was in there trying to get a song down or something.
He wanted to be the best at everything he ever did. They were not at all concerned about the working. We worked all day and all night.
I mean, this kid at 9 meant serious business. I mean, this kid meant serious, serious business. I mean, he was not kidding.
He questioned Nick and I about our early Motown songs, you know. He always wanted to know, how'd you come up with this idea? What was this? What made you say that? You know, songs like Ain't Nothing Like the Real Thing. He was a real student.
I was fascinated by the fact that he had this kind of commitment and this kind of dedication and was inquisitive about it. He was always watching. He would always be watching, man.
Well, who else do you think makes the stage come to real life besides me and Ed Sullivan?
Sammy Davis Jr.
Hold it. You're beginning to see me, kid. You understand that?
Best experience in the world. Just sitting on the wings and learning. Oh, I ate that up.
And he would sit with me at mixing sessions because I did a lot of mixing. He would sit there for hours and hours. I would tell somebody, one of my assistants, I'd say, well, my back is turned, but I know Michael is staring at me.
The thing I loved about Motown was that a Berry Gordy, if he didn't like a song, he'd go in the studio and cut one himself. Yeah. And so Berry Gordy, in my opinion, is probably the greatest record man that ever was.
Berry was wonderful with taking a song and leading it to the right direction, giving it the right flavors to make it a hit. He knew just what it, you know, what it takes, and everybody can't do that.
Where Willard ended, Ben begins. Ben is coming from Cinerama Releasing, and this time he's not alone.
And then came Ben, which was a soundtrack to a movie about rats. And wherever we tour, the whole world demand to hear. We can't get off stage, people start chanting for Ben.
This performance of Ben at the Academy Awards in 1973 was the first time that Michael really stepped out on his own.
The first nominated song is Ben, from the picture Ben. It'll be sung by a young man whose talent is mature, but whose age suggests that maybe he shouldn't even be up this late.
Michael Jackson, age 14. Need no more. We both found what we were looking for. John Leguizamo, actor.
He was part of your whole life. It was crazy, man. When you were a little kid with all the Jackson 5 songs Then when you're, you know, when you're a little older, then through your puberty, your adolescence.
The Jacksons, London, 1979.
And then when you go to college, and then it just, he was always around defining a part of your life.
There's so many steps in between that first day and off the wall. For me, the most heartbreaking was when they left Motown.
Soul Train, October 27th, 1973. Questlove, music journalist.
They came in as bubblegum. No one ever graduates from being a cute kid group to being taken seriously.
There's no child singer that you can point to besides Michael Jackson that went from being really big to the biggest pop star ever.
Thank God for Dance Machine.
On Soul Train, Michael busts robotic moves while the audience is dancing. He turns with a serious expression, then smiles.
What they were observing at the time at Motown, what the Jacksons were observing, were a lot of the artists having creative freedom.
Marlon Jackson, artist, the Jackson 5 and the Jacksons.
We wanted to write. We wanted to produce ourselves. And our contract in Motown didn't let us do that.
And plus our contract was expiring at the time, and it was time to make a new change.
Two guys named Ronald Luxemburg and Steve Popovich. Okay, and they were with Epic. One was head of promotion, one was head of A&R. And they came to me and said, we're going to sign the Jacksons, you know, as a group.
It all started at the Warwick Hotel, and there's nothing but kids around the whole hotel. I went to the doorman, and I said, what's going on here? And he said, the Jackson 5 are here. And it gave me the opportunity to go just the way I am. Into the lobby. I picked up the house phone and I called and I said, Michael Jackson, please. And they rang right through to room 805. And he came downstairs with his dad. And I looked at him and I said, what do you want to do? And he said, someday I'd like to do my own music. I said, really? What about now?
The group wanted to leave Motown. Joseph.
My name is Joe Jackson.
Thought that he wanted to bring them and take them to a whole other level that Motown just couldn't do.
But I was told not to sign them. And I was told that they were a cartoon act. And I went to Walter Yetnikoff, who was my boss, and I said, hold on. The Jacksons belong on this label. We call ourselves the family of music. This is the family. I want to sign them.
I said, well, I don't know how many records they've sold. So I went to hear that the Westbury Music Fair, Michael was 15 years old at the time. He's singing a song to a dead rat, which you remember, named Ben. Okay, and I come back and I said to these guys, are you crazy? I was signing, we're going to give him $3.5 million.
I said, Walter, please. You know, you're new in your job, and you're really not qualified to judge this.
I was in the job like 3 weeks when that happened.
He was like, okay, I'll go along with you guys. You know, you seem to know what you're doing.
I said, you know, you're probably right. That was my brilliant move in signing the Jacksons.
Walter Yetnikoff, President CBS Records, 1975 to 1990.
The most tense time of life for me was the changing from Motown to CBS. I was in a whole nother world. I didn't know what was happening.
Understanding the challenge of a child prodigy having to make a transition from now being a serious, serious artist, how much courage it takes to actually step outside of that and to come with a new sound. That could be pretty damn scary.
Kind of a critical decision that the Jackson 5 with their father, Joe Jackson, made to leave Motown. And it resulted in a lawsuit, out of which came a name change to the Jacksons.
I was told I couldn't use the name Jackson 5, and I said, it's okay, we'll call them the Jacksons.
Because Barry Gordy did not let that name go.
We were all sad that he was gone, and Jermaine stayed.
Jermaine Jackson was married to the daughter of Berry Gordy, so probably not a good idea for him to leave Motown with the rest of his family.
We respect Jermaine's decision because that was a very difficult decision for him to make. And I respect him for that because he did what he wants to do. I want people to do what they want to do. Don't do what I want you to do. Do what you feel that's best for you.
There's so much going on, so much tension. I wasn't sure what was going to happen.
I asked Michael, what's going to happen when people ask you, why are you leaving Motown? And he said, because everything is possible with you at Epic Records. There's nothing more to be said.
And with Columbia Records,
We want to sell twice as many records. We want to do the things that we've dreamed of.
There was not a popular signing in the business, nor was it in the building. Ron's lost his mind. You know, the Jacksons have had it. They're done.
The problem at that time is they had had a cartoon series, and their credibility was questionable.
Bobby Columbi, producer and musician. Now the cartoon series intro.
I'm going to give them as much credibility as I possibly can.
We got on the train, went to Philadelphia. Gamble and Huff opened their drawer full of hits.
When you think of disco and when you think of quality disco, you came to Philadelphia.
Two of the people that Michael Jackson learned from immensely were Kenny Gamble and Leon Huff, who were the creators and entrepreneurs behind Philly International.
The proprietors of the disco sound.
They had always wanted to write and produce their own records, you know what I mean, and be a part of the process. And that's pretty much what Philly International was. It was a place where you had a lot of creative freedom.
They wrote tons of hits, I mean, tons of hits.
We had Al Melvin and the Blue Notes, we had the OJs.
Go through the roster.
We had Patti LaBelle.
Archie Bell and the Drells.
Phyllis Hyman.
Billy Paul.
Lou Rawls. We had Teddy Pendergrass.
3 Degrees.
3 Degrees. We had to style these songs to fit these guys' voices.
And that's what great producers do, right?
Sure.
We're right almost in the middle of a recording session with the Jacksons. And guess who is producing their brand new album? Gamble and Huff.
That's right.
Now, why would you guys come all the way in from California to cut some sides in an album in Philadelphia?
Because Gamble and Huff Organization is here, and they're two of the best producers in the world.
Working with Gamble and Huff, they do it in a little quicker pace. It takes 3 weeks to make a record. I didn't know you can make a record in 3 weeks, a whole album.
They were the Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis of the 70s.
And Michael always says that he learned a lot about the songwriting process from Kenny Gamble and Leon Huff, how to structure a song, how to create great arrangements.
And the Jacksons came to Philadelphia for 2 years to record two records, The Jacksons and Going Places.
We try to write songs that people do all the time, or people say things all the time. Enjoy yourself, me. People say that all the time, so, you know, enjoy yourself.
The Jacksons, Dinah, November 12th, 1976. Michael spins, then grooves together with two of his brothers.
He was driven by the music, he loved the music, and
he's gonna learn.
One of the most important things to being successful is listening. It's listening and watching. And being a good person to work with, easy to work with.
Every song is a negotiation. Every production is a negotiation if you're co-doing it with someone.
You know, the producer wanted me to pronounce words a certain way.
There was a song, and there's a line in it where he sings,
"Now I'm a man that's for all seasons, and where the city offers me ain't naturally."
Ain't naturally sings that, and I go, oh, no, that's bad English. So I say, hang on, Mike, and I come out. And I said, so it's like, isn't naturally, or isn't natural?
I told him you pronounce the word so precisely, it takes away from the feeling of the song. And we got into a little thing with that.
There's a lot of give and take, and sometimes you don't want to give. Or sometimes you give, but you feel like, I should have left it the way it was.
Something said in my brain, shut the fuck up. Stop being the grammar police. This guy's a genius. Just get out of his way.
I was right, and I won. But it was a good learning point.
You want to 100% express your idea. It's just 100% expression of me.
We have two singles on the album coming out in December on Epic. First time we've written some songs on the album.
It was a different style, but still it was a hit record. So when we started putting that together with what we heard amongst the brothers, it created our own style of music.
It's time to write. Something will let you know that it's time for you to go out and do it yourself. So we decided to write and produce our own songs.
And we finally did. And we went through so much, you know, with people not believing in your work or saying, are you sure, are you sure? And we said, yeah, we know we can. We know what we can do. And we went in and we wrote the Destiny album.
I felt it was something that came within from us. And this is the Jacksons. This is us today.
On the Destiny album, which is the album that comes out in 1978, a year prior to Off the Wall, he's starting to make those moves. He wrote Shake Your Body Down to the Ground.
Where were you when you first heard about that record? How'd it happen?
It was at home, and Randy was playing this groove on the piano. Mm-hmm. Da, da, da. I said, what is that? He said, oh, it's nothing. I said, don't say that. It is something. And I just started singing to his playing, mm-hmm. and it came about.
I called some of my friends out here that I had a lot of respect for that knew how to arrange. I thought the key to really making an album of a vocal band like this is obviously great musicians, great arrangements.
Bobby Columbi convinced me that I should get more into arranging. He said, and here's who you're going to do it with. And next thing you know, I'm in a room with the Jacksons.
Then we brought Greg in to come and help us with the record on Destiny album again. Yeah. Man, shoot.
Amazing. Everybody was using Greg for the
games. It was soup then.
When I first heard the demo for Shake Your Body, it was, you know, obviously the melody was there, which was very strong. And they had the basic piano part, you know, that you hear the dun, 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 all that rhythm was there.
Original demo.
But there wasn't as much going on rhythmically.
Greg came up with it.
Like, that's the rhythm of Shake Your Body Down to the Ground, which the average song was more like.
It fit perfectly.
At first, when he came up with that beat, I said, what is this guy doing? And I said that to myself. I didn't say anything, but I waited till he played it. And man, when he played it,
yes,
and we heard it in the record, I said, oh my God, this is the bomb. Because I'd never heard a beat like that before, you know, and it was incredible. Mm-hmm. Great beat.
I said, does the Jacksons ever need a drummer? Let them know your friend is in town. The guy's name is James McPhail, keyboard player who got me the audition. And Tito said that. He had his arm on his guitar, and he said, let's play Shake Your Body Down. Like this kind of look. He said, you know that one? So I started playing the beat. And they're looking at each other, the Jackson brothers whispering each other's ear. And they're like looking, and I'm like saying, oh no, I'm blowing it. Because that beat is very tricky. You have to know when and how to cross your arms to make the toms happen, the intricate hi-hat happen, and keep the beat going without losing any of the elements. And then Randy, he said, nobody could play that beat. That was a three-part overdub. And I said, really? I said, I thought the guy played it one time. And they were shocked and amazed I could play it. And they said, you're our drummer.
We had Tom 84 doing the horn arrangements, who is a horn arranger out of Chicago who did all the Earth, Wind & Fire's. Horn arrangement. Then we got Earth, Wind & Fire horn players to come in and play. I mean, horn players love that lick.
It's as dissonant and tension-provoking a verse musically. You can't. And I'm going, what's going on? Where's the bridge? Where's the solo? When are we? I'm just used to other form. Epic's really not interested in them at all at this point. It was kind of like, oh God, we got to put this out. I get a call from Paris Ely. He's head of promotion for the R&B department. And he says, hey man, Shake Your Body's a hit.
I want to show you, first of all, the album, and then show you the inside, if I may. And from left to right, they are Randy and Tito and Jackie and Marlon and Michael, and they are the Jacksons.
American Bandstand, February 10th, 1979.
That enabled people to see Michael Jackson finally as an adult.
Because it was musical. It was a long way from ABC, and I want you back.
Vadeen White, bassist with Earth, Wind & Fire. On American Bandstand, the Jacksons are in baby blue outfits. Michael picks a young woman from the audience, and they dance. A policeman comes on stage waving his arms. He tries to get some order, then joins in.
There's a moment in the demo of Shake Your Body Down to the Ground which clearly let me know that they had their eyes on a bigger prize. It's 1978, and the biggest selling album of all time is Saturday Night Fever. And there's a moment that you can hear Jackie in the background say, "Psh, I can't wait till the Bee Gees hear this shit.
I want the Bee Gees to hear this shit."
The Jacksons' Triumph Tour in L.A., 1981.
We wrote, produced by the Jacksons, all songs written by the Jacksons. Well, Mick Jackson, a white kid that lived in England, wrote Blame It on the Boogie. He didn't lie. His name is Jackson.
Blame It on the Boogie, directed by Peter Conn. Multiple images of dancing feet. Now, a live version.
So Michael starts singing. He throws the headphones down and bolts out of the studio. I turn to the engineer. Did he get feedback? Was something? He goes, "No, nothing." I go out to the hall. He's dancing. It was unbelievable. He's spinning around. He goes, "I'm sorry." He said, I can't stand still and sing that section. I got to get this out."
He had watched James Brown, the Nicholas Brothers, and Sammy Davis.
He can see somebody dance one time, like Freddie Stair and some of those other stars. And he can do just exactly what they easy to catch on.
Jackie Wilson, which I used to watch on the wings every day on stage. Mm-hmm. We would play at the Regal Theater, six shows a day. We would come on amateur hour.
Oh, my gosh.
I would just watch him. And Sammy Davis Jr. is another one of my favorites.
You can't go wrong watching Sammy Davis Jr.
Yeah.
To watch him and to see and suddenly see little flashes, flatteringly I say this about myself, little flashes of me there and go, wow. But he's extended it, he's changed it, he's colored it till it becomes his own.
He introduced me to Fred Astaire and all these movies, and I had no idea who the hell these people were prior to that, mm-hmm. right? And he just, you know, he opened up my eyes to a whole nother world of inspiration.
I just want to let you know I have all your films on tape and I watch them all the time. And I want to ask you one question. How do you do that thing when you, walk on the ceiling, you dance. Really, I want to know, how did that work?
The whole room and the camera turn.
So they both turn, right?
Yes.
Michael Jackson with the Nicholas Brothers. The Jackson Variety Show, February 23rd, 1977. An intricate, synchronized tap dancing routine. Gene Kelly, dancer, actor, director, 1989.
Michael's dance is based on energy, and he moves like an electric eel. He's got, I think the adjective electric is good for him. He's charged with energy, but he has the good inner sense, or wherever it comes from, his brain, wherever, to just take it down and then up again quickly, which good dancers naturally have. I came out after the war, after I was in the Navy, and I wanted to dance the common man. I didn't want to dance in white tie or tuxedo and dressed up. I wanted to roll up my sleeves and wear jeans and T-shirts. And the nearest thing I could get to dancing shoes were loafers and the white socks and the rolled up jeans. And he's dancing from the streets, like I was. I believe that.
I was a teenager and I was getting older. I started to really understand the power of dance. The way he could spin, stop on a dime, and point with such intensity, that's the power I'm talking about.
And I'd perfect a certain amount of moves. There is beauty and simplicity and really stripping things down. And I learned that from him. He impacted everything for me, absolutely. He impacted my game on the court. He impacted me now, to this day, and how I learned.
Watching him was like something I'd never seen before. It was something that was magical, that was creative, that seemed like something that I could mimic. That's how I found my love for dance before I found classical ballet.
I used to ask him, I said, man, how much do you practice? He said, you know, I would dance until I can't dance no more. I said, what do you mean? I danced in my legs. I physically could not move.
There's a lot of people who just don't have that same type of drive. You see it in an artist like Beyonce. That kind of drive.
You know, a lot of times when it comes to Black artists, it happens with Basquiat, it happens with Miles Davis, with Michael Jackson. People talk about their kind of natural gifts as if there's not strategy and skill and craft, as if Miles Davis didn't go to Juilliard, or Basquiat didn't know who Monet and Renoir were, or Michael Jackson hadn't been doing this his entire life.
Some of my favorite writers are Joni Mercer, Irving Berlin, George Gershwin, Duke Ellington, Count Basie.
No, you gotta put the work in, man. You gotta put the time in. And really, man, it's love that you're putting in. You know, because people that do this kind of stuff, man, we love what we do.
This is dated November 6, 1979. He was on the road with his brothers on the Destiny Tour. MJ will be my new name, no more Michael Jackson. I want a whole new character, a whole new look. I should be a totally different person. People should never think of me as the kid who sang ABC, I Want You Back. I should be a new, incredible actor, singer, dancer that will shock the world. I will do no interviews. I will be magic. I will be a perfectionist, a researcher, a trainer, a master. I will be better than every great actor roped in one. I must have the most incredible training system to dig and dig and dig until I find. I will study and look back on the whole world of entertainment and perfect it. Take it steps further from where the greatest left off.
You guys are really riding a big high now as far as producing records and so on. Do you think this is the peak of your career now, or have you gone down a little bit? Are you expecting bigger and better things?
What are you looking forward to in the future, man?
Recording other artists and going into acting. We get a lot of scripts in, but we haven't found the exact script that we want to use. Mm-hmm. So we're picking and deciding.
Think you may be a big movie star one day, huh?
Yeah, I'd like to give it a try.
Yeah, it's a good business to be in. You got the looks, you know? Fortunately, I didn't, what?
With the advent of motion pictures came an abundance of Oz films. A 1925 version starred Oliver Hardy as the Tin Man. And who'll ever forget the 1939 MGM musical version starring Judy Garland? In 1974, The Wiz opened on Broadway, winning 7 Tony Awards.
I was a senior in high school. And there was this girl named Barbara Hampton, who I liked. And I wanted to impress her. I was working at Baskin-Robbins. I just saved my money. I finally got up enough courage to ask her, would you like to go see The Wiz with me? I got 2 great seats at center aisle. She said, nah, I don't think so.
Spike Lee.
Scalped them for double the price.
I took Michael the first time to see The Wiz. He went back 30 more times.
The Wiz, when it came out in 1978, was the, you know, Lamette's movie adaptation of that great long-running play that was on Broadway with Stephanie Mills. There was a great debate, at least in my neighborhood, that Diana Ross is dope, but the only reason why they cast is because she's Diana Ross. Stephanie Mills would have been a better fit for the film, but for whatever reason, she didn't get the job.
We're not gonna do it with an unknown young actress. We have to have the star power to make it cross over.
It also was the most expensive movie ever made with an all African-American cast.
So because of Car Wash and Sparkle, and you know this happens in Hollywood, mm-hmm. where you designate as the go-to guy for Black material.
I was the Black writer.
The Black writer, huh?
And Sidney was probably the number one American director right then, because he had done Serpico, Dog Day Afternoon, Network, Murder on the Orient Express, I think all in a row. He was king,
right,
and definitely king of New York.
Michael was desperate to play the Scarecrow.
Always wanted to have a film career. There was some rumor that he was supposed to star in the Frankie Lyman story that never happened. The Wiz was supposed to be a huge film. Diana Ross, his longtime pal, is starring in it.
He's no longer in Motown. And Michael called Berry Gordy.
We were doing The Wiz. Rob Korn was handling it. He was working for me at the time with Motown Productions.
It would have been very easy for him to say, well, you know, Michael, you're gone now, and I think we'll find somebody else.
Sidney was adamant that he didn't want Michael. He felt Michael was over and had been a cute little kid, musical star, but hadn't grown into it. And I just said, you're making a mistake, and I want you to meet him. Of course, Lumet fell in love with Michael.
Michael may be the purest talent I've ever seen. He's incapable of a false moment. He's so true that anything around him has to become true. If you don't work honestly around him, you're going to look as if you're faking it.
Well, yeah, he's all those things. Plus, this kid can dance and sing like nobody else.
It was so obvious, the genius of this boy. I mean, it was so effortless.
When I was real small and I saw the original Wizard of Oz, the Judy Garland version, I always fell in love with the Scarecrow. I think most kids do because you feel sorry for him and everything. And he's so his character. And I always watched them. As a matter of fact, I had the step down they did when I was around six. I would do it all around the house. Follow the yellow brick road.
Ta-da! Woo! Come on, Dorothy! Come on!
Woo! Ease on Down the Road, 1978.
Come on then, ease on down.
Matter of fact, that hill that we do ease on down the road was going uphill, and Diana and me, we were so out of breath, we had to do it a couple of times, really. I mean, it was going straight up.
The Scarecrow and Dorothy dancing along the yellow brick road.
He'd come in for a five-hour makeup call in the morning, get the makeup out of the way, right on the case. He knew everybody's lines, everybody's songs, he knew everybody's position, and he stood there almost at attention. And I saw this uncanny type discipline in such a young person.
Quincy, of course, was the musical director. He was doing the score for The Wiz.
And you see him for a minute, right? You see him for a minute conducting the band in the movie. And I was a Quincy fan, you know, Smackwater Jack, Walking in Space, Body Heat, all that stuff. The Wiz seemed like a great combination of all these things that he could do.
Lumet was very happy to have Quincy. We all were. That just kind of guaranteed the musical portion would hit a strong popular chord.
He didn't actually have a feature number in the film when they hired him. They didn't know about the dancing or a lot of things. And eventually everybody came to understand what he was all about.
The Scarecrow's fixed to a frame.
They showed enough of his dancing.
The real night that Off the Wall was born, we were doing the pre-records for the movie. Quincy had, like, tunnel vision on Diana Ross. Finally, about 2 a.m., Q had what he wanted from Diana, and he goes, okay, Michael, you come in on bar 6. And Michael starts, like, at 1,000 watts. And he's doing everything that became the signature Michael Jackson. Woo!
Come on, Dorothy!
And it was like a lioness who just suddenly sees a baby goat. It was just...
The more I knew him, and the more I became fascinated with the idea of maybe working with him.
It was a lot of fun working with all the greats. Sidney Lumet, Quincy Jones, everybody.
I may be, I don't know, one of the few people who really love The Wiz. There's some great representation on film that we hadn't seen before.
When The Wiz came out, I was 7 years old. That was an event for Black America.
I can't speak for all of New York City, I can't speak for all of the country, but everybody in my neighborhood in Harlem was going to see The Wiz because of Mike Jackson.
So this is a big moment for Michael Jackson. He gets to fulfill his acting desires, and he's finally in a big Hollywood film. So he and his sister LaToya moved to New York.
I found him an apartment on 400 East 56th Street off First Avenue.
In the summer of 77, a legendary summer, there were blackouts, there was a serial killer, David Berkowitz, the son of Sam, who's doing all these random killings. People were terrified. The first summer of disco, it was the time in which all of these nascent music forms were coming up. Punk, hip-hop, Disco was huge. And there were all these different elements that were happening in New York at the same time that were sort of coming in contact with each other or clashing with each other. I have a feeling that's probably where he first heard a lot of early hip hop, the beatboxing that he's basically doing on a song like Working Day and Night. Even though he's only 19, he was going to Studio 54 on a regular basis.
Perhaps you've heard the name Studio 54. It attracts the rich and the famous, the glamorous and the powerful. They come to this disco palace in New York City just about any night of the week.
He was making all kinds of eccentric and unusual friends that, you know, now we see the photos of and it looks really strange, just hanging out with Liza Minnelli.
Hi, sweetheart. Okay, just hanging out in New York?
Yeah, Studio 54.
Come here a lot?
Oh, God, yes.
Why?
Because I like the atmosphere of Studio 54. I've been to a lot of discotheques and I don't like them.
Honestly. What's the difference?
I don't know, the feeling. I mean, the excitement of the props coming down and the balcony. It's just exciting, honestly.
I'm certain that his experience and going to Studio 54 during the filming of The Wiz played a big part in where he wanted this album played. And it doesn't mean that he wanted to make a disco record. He is a dancer. He's a marvelous dancer. He's an influential, innovative dancer.
Well, why do you dance for fun?
Because you're just being free then. Most of the time it's set choreography when we're on stage. It's stuff you have to do every night. When you dance here, you're just free. You dance with whoever you want to. You just go wild.
What about the craziness? It gets crazy and wild. And...
No, it doesn't. No. Not only is it fun to dance, it's fun to look at, you know, other people. You walk around and you see all kind of things, like Darth Vader was here the other night. It was incredible.
I'm sure he was making these observations of what was going on around him. He was kind of self-conscious about himself and kind of shy. So he wasn't trying to be around all of the wildness, all of the freakness. You know what I'm saying? He would go in a DJ booth and just watch people and make these mental notes, and I'm sure musical notes also.
And I think all of that shows up on Off the Wall because it's certainly one of the most sensual albums he ever released. It contains the sort of exuberance and the sexuality.
It's where you come when you want to escape. It's really escapism. We left Motown, you know, a certain amount of albums for the Jacksons and a certain amount for me as a solo artist.
He's coming out as an autonomous figure, separate from his father, separate from his brothers, and really establishing himself as a solo act.
He says, I called Quincy and said, do you know anybody who could produce the album? I had songs I really wanted to do. I wasn't asking him to do it. He said, why don't you let me do it? I said, that's a great idea.
That's a great idea.
I mean, there was some speculation, you know, would Quincy be the right guy? He's a jazz guy. Would he be, you know?
They didn't think that he can make him a contemporary hit record that everybody in the whole world would like.
I don't think that this is possible to sit down and try to intellectualize and theorize about how you can make a record that can appeal to many, many people. Just the people in this room, you know, it's very difficult to try to make a record that everybody in this room would like.
The label had other ideas about who he should go with. They wanted Maurice White was one of the people, and they also wanted Gamble and Huff to work with him.
Michael came back all teary-eyed one day and said, the people at Epic don't want to use you. They said, you're too jazzy, you know, you don't understand this kind of music.
But they don't know. You know, these guys don't know. The A&R men, they don't know.
Thank God he went back and he and with Freddie DeMann and Ron Weiser, and they fought and they said, he's doing it.
Quincy called me one day and said, we're going to do Michael Jackson's album, his first solo album. And I thought to myself, holy cow, I better get serious. Because I don't get those kind of calls very often.
When you discover Off the Wall for the first time, forget all the music for a second. Let's just talk about the sonics, the sound of it. The sonic of that album stands up against any album right now, period.
Because it's raw. It was before drum machines, before heavy computer programming.
Making an album is totally different today than what it was. Because when we made those albums back in the day, we had live musicians, live drummer.
That way you get magic, you know, you get a little bit of magic. And if somebody's playing just a little bit under or something like that, that's all part of making the record breathe.
That's a pulse.
It's pulse. It's like, yeah, it's a pulse. Yeah, it's, mm-hmm. But today everything is right on. Today
because they
right
quantize
on.
Every damn thing.
Everything is right on today.
These were like living, breathing recordings that were for the dance floor. Machines are great, but incredible musicians, I feel like, will beat it every time.
I'm always telling engineers, like, you better study and listen. If they were able to accomplish that type of fullness and that type of sound, they're able to do that then, you better be able to do something great now, or you're fired.
What Quincy has is an extraordinary history.
He's leading the band behind Count Basie.
Working with Frank Sinatra.
Sammy Davis Jr.
Pawnbroker.
Heat of the Night.
Sanford and Son.
Studied in France under a great orchestration.
Nadia Boulanger, who taught Ravel.
And he's unlimited musical. He can, you want anything, he can do it. Jazz, folk, pop, classical, soul, gospel, anything.
Michael wrote three songs on the Off the Wall album, Don't Stop Till You Get Enough, Working Day and Night, and Get on the Floor. He wanted the freedom to develop as an artist, and writing these three songs was very important to him.
Don't Stop Till You Get Enough, original demo.
The demos are kind of a revelation in that they really illuminate Michael's abilities as a songwriter and show how developed these songs were when he brought them to Quincy Jones. You really see Michael's rhythmic sophistication.
Dun, 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 dun. That's what did it.
Boom, boom, dun, 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 dun. That's the phrase that pays. That's the hook right there. Michael ain't gotta say a word yet. They could play that bass line and they could run it nonstop.
Opening bars of that record is just like, you could be playing the worst set of your life, or you're at a wedding, or you're at a club, it doesn't matter. And you just first, dun, 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 it's just like, ah!
You kind of get this little tick, you know, that's going on. Anybody that you're around, you know, they're just down for it. Even the guys try to be hard, like, you know, it's you just in there.
You know, I was wondering, you know, if you could keep on, because the force, it's got a lot of power, and it makes me feel like it makes me feel like
the song I use to reset my day. It's the song that I use when I need to be motivated. It's my absolute favorite Michael Jackson song.
These are my own songs. I'm going to communicate my own thoughts, my own emotions, my own ideas, my own kind of rhythmic sensibility, vocal trademarks. I mean, that, you hear a lot of that in these songs, completely uninhibited. You feel his energy coming through because you feel that freedom.
And that's the first time we heard that iconic yell. That's his Free at Last, Free at Last.
I was in Buffalo with you. Fantastic show. You darn near blinded me there, man. That thing is dynamite when you come out. They have to see that, you jumping out of there.
Oh, don't stop.
Michael makes his entrance on the Destiny Tour of 1979. His brothers join him.
Don't Stop Till You Get Enough had this kind of like, this opening groove, right? And the opening groove kind of sets you off. If you were a dancer, you know, you let that sink in.
I always use Michael as, first and foremost, as a vocal inspiration. And Off the Wall was definitely the one that made me feel like I could sing. I found my falsetto because of Off the Wall. Don't Stop Till You Get Enough.
These bizarre lyrics, well, to me, these bizarre lyrics that were quoting Star Wars.
I didn't even know he was saying, keep on with the force, don't stop. I thought it was about forks. When I was a kid, I was just like, keep on with the forks. I didn't know what the forks were.
Live, wearing his loafers and sparkling white socks, Michael kicks high. Holding his jacket open, he moves along the front of the stage, then spins before continuing to the beat. Heading back, he lifts his trouser legs to show off the jeweled socks. He dances on the spot, then slowly lifts one shiny shoe, strikes a couple of poses, then lifts the other foot. Bounding across the stage, he takes his jacket off, swings it around his head, then throws it into the crowd. Valerie Simpson, artist and songwriter.
I remember the video. I mean, you know, he just looked like $1 million, you know. I think that's before they had $1 million to spend, too.
Right.
So it was done for relatively a small amount of money, and yet he had to single-handedly sell it.
A green light behind Michael in a sparkling costume.
Skaters anthem. There was a skate obsession in the United States in 79, 80, where it was like, I'm going to roller skate.
A good song to roller skate, it should feel like the floor to your skates. It should be the foundation for all of that flowing.
Dream Hampton, cultural critic. Film of skaters at a roller disco.
It seemed like there was symbolism behind the video. They had like the halo around the angels, the shiny suit. I mean, he made that look cool. I can never pull that off, but.
I can listen to Rock With You and know where I was the first time I heard it at Pegasus. When that song came on, people just stopped in the club. They just froze, you know? And then slowly, one by one, they got on the dance floor.
The Jacksons' Triumph Tour, LA, 1981.
Tempo, but it's smooth. That's fast. It's hard to make up-tempo music where you can dance, be emotional at the same time.
Most people just get into a groove, so most of the times you don't get that much of a real song there. So they don't stand up as well as a good storytelling ballad through the years. You want stuff that's gonna have legs, that's gonna hold on. And his up-tempo really does hold on because he really crafted a real song on top of a great groove.
I loop that breathing exercise on working day and night. I loop that for at least a minute before I let that song go. Like, I hold people at bay. Like, I'm holding back, like, 12 pit bulls. Like, you know what's going on? Ah, get him!
The Triumph Tour. Lee Daniels, producer and filmmaker.
I'm embarrassed to even say this, but I used to dance by myself to that song.
Ooh, honey, you got me working, damn.
mean, working day and night. You could tell just where he was rhythmically, just by the ones he was writing. Really catchy, rhythmic dance songs.
Michael's reference is certainly American R&B and soul and funk, but I also hear Africa in there. And you have to also remember the Jackson 5 toured Africa in the 70s. Woo!
It's crazy. That was just the high watermark of horn lines to me.
Mark Ronson, producer. The brothers dancing to the horn section.
There's all these instrumental stretches and breaks in these songs that give the musicians some shine too.
David had this certain David Williams sound, yeah. Had this certain sound
that
like
bites.
He bent it, he hit him so hard.
David Williams, guitarist. Randy Jackson, percussionist. Randy's smiling as he plays the beats.
Sometimes he'll take it upon himself to bring the rhythm that he wanted, and that really influenced me.
He always had an idea of what he wanted every instrument to sound like, and that's how he recorded. You came in the studio, and he told the guitar player,
he would
sing every part. He didn't play it, but he can sing it, and if you didn't play it like he sang it, he would sing it till you played it like he sang it. God damn it.
I do believe deeply in perfection. I'm never satisfied. I'll cut a track, go back and back and back, and darn it, I should have done this, I should have did it. It's number one on the charts. You're still screaming about what you should have done.
It's evident. When you see somebody's work, you can see the details, and if they actually truly love what they do, if they really do pay attention to the craft.
Perfection was the name of the game. It's about the content of what you do, the quality, the heart, the soul, the love.
I think this generation has just become the perception has become skewed. The love for the craft becomes secondary to the love of fame and notoriety. My generation, the Jordan generation, Bird, Magic, you know, Michael Jackson, they focused on what they love to do.
One of the hidden gems is Get on the Floor, which was co-penned by Louis Johnson from Brothers Johnson and co-written with Michael.
I don't know if everybody knows this, but you're also a composer. One of my favorites was Michael Jackson's Get on the Floor and Dance.
Originally, that song was created by the bass. I just had that groove.
Louis Johnson, Off the Wall, Thriller, and Dangerous. Last Hustle in Brooklyn, 1977, directed by Spike Lee. People dancing outside in the sunshine. Rosie Perez, actor, dancer, choreographer.
There are routines in the playgrounds. And you know, like I'm dating myself, okay. But you know, you would bring the little radio, or sometimes if you were really tacky, you would bring the little portable record player, plop it down in the park, drop the needle. So heck yeah.
If you were dancing to that song, more than likely you were going home with somebody. Because that's not a song you dance on your own to. You know, just you don't dance to Get on the Floor by yourself.
In the park, a crowd are grooving to the music while couples are dancing together.
Off the Wall is a DJ's dream.
The A side seems to have been tailor-made for the dance floor.
You basically have five songs. The first four songs on side one, and the first song on side two, Off the Wall.
My favorite record on Off the Wall, I like Off the Wall. That's one of my favorite records.
I took a chance with
a composer that I have loved his work for a long time, and I could never figure out how he could be from Grimsby, England, living in Worms, Germany, and understand Ain't No Half-Steppin', you know, and all of those different terms that he was writing. It was just incredible talent.
He ended up in Germany and being turned on to soul music by a bunch of the Black Army people that were there.
Black American soldiers.
Black American soldiers. Mm-hmm. And going, wow, this is a lot more interesting than what I'm doing. And girls come to these shows.
In early Heat Wave, you can hear those influences in songs he wrote for Michael. I mean, it's just a natural progression.
And we recorded Furnace Disco Out, Off the Wall, and Rock With You.
Wow. Rod Temperton did good.
Off the Wall is an example of him bringing that slightly, like, proggy fusion aspect to it. It's a really unconventional start for a disco record, especially, like, the title track of an album. It starts with that. It starts on the offbeat, it starts on the two, it has that weird vocal thing in the background. It's totally proggy.
That intro with the kind of ghoulish voices and so on. You start to hear that again, of course, on Thriller with the Vincent Price.
The Energetic LA Concert, 1981. When the world is on your shoulder, gotta straighten up your act and boogie down. If you can't get rid of the feeling, then there ain't no one who's gonna be done. Cause we're the body, for night and day. Live it well, we got the only way to show tonight. It's not about emotion, it's just enjoy yourself. On the LP, Girlfriend by McCartney.
Girlfriend was a song on the London Town album by Paul McCartney.
Girlfriend, I'm gonna tell you a boyfriend. I love it.
Girlfriend, I'm gonna tell you boyfriend, yeah.
I felt like Michael was singing to me on that one, I did.
If we go out together and a bunch of girls start following me, let's hear what you say to them to make them go away.
Get away from him. He's mine, not yours.
The Dating Game, 1972.
Same question number two.
Yo, listen, okay? Michael Jackson is mine.
Rosie Perez.
Some of the songs that I sing, my favorite is ballads. I kind of listen to the words, and it's really relating something.
I wrote She's Out of My Life as a result of being very much in love with a wonderful young woman. Do you ever get so upset that you're speaking yourself out loud? Well, I was. I was in the car on the Pasadena freeway, and I'm saying, man, she was there for you. She loved you. She wanted to marry you. You're the one who said no. Face it. She's out of your life. Saturday morning, the phone rings, and it's Q, and he says, hey, man, you've been writing. And I played the song, and it's ringing out, and he said, play it again. I played it again. Played it 8 times in a row. And at the end of it, he said, what are you going to do with it? And I said, well, I made a deal with Snuffy yesterday. He's going to do it with Sinatra. And he says, this Q-ism, Sinatra will do it anyway. And I said, okay, Q, then who do you want to do it with? He said, I haven't got a clue. He said, Nan, if you'll trust me, I promise you, an unforgettable recording of this song. And we sat on it for almost 2 years, Spike.
To write a great ballad, first of all, lyrically, the content has to connect. And to me, part of what makes a song connect is that it's personal, but it's also universal.
Michael Jackson, yes, he's a great entertainer, he was a great dancer, but he was also a great singer. Not a good singer, but a great singer.
I liked his performance on She's Out of My Life. Really emotional.
The quality of Michael's voice was so incredibly pure.
She's out of my life. She's out of my life. And I don't know whether to laugh or cry. don't know whether to live or die, and it cuts like a knife. She's out of my life.
I cried every time that he performed She's Out of My Life, and he would cry too.
Everyone relates She's Out of My Life to Eddie Murphy, right? Anyone who was growing up in the 80s, we saw Delirious first.
That's Michael's hook, his sensitivity. That's what women be saying, Michael's just so sensitive. And they eat that shit up. Mike, no, too, he be using women in concerts. I seen Mike walk up to girls on the stage, be in the audience. He said,
can I come down there?
And the women go, ah! Then if you don't scream, Michael get real sensitive and cry on your ass. If you hear that record, She's Out of My Life, Michael go,
so I've learned that love's not possession. Yeah, and I've learned that love won't win. No, I've learned that love needs expression. But I've learned too late, and she's out of my life. She's out of my life. Damn indecision and cursed pride. I kept my love for her like deep inside, and it cuts like a knife. She's out of my.
He bends over, then straightens up and wipes his eye. He lifts the mic to his mouth again. Eddie Murphy with his Michael impression. He pulls an emotional expression, struggling to get words out.
Tito, get me some tissue.
And I had an opportunity to listen to the stems where he's trying different takes. And he actually apologizes for messing the song up.
I'm sorry I messed it up.
It's amazing, because every time he sang it, he cried. And I was trying to figure out what relationship he had, you know, that he could identify with that. So he did it 2 or 3 times. I said, that's the way it's supposed to be, and just let it stay in there.
A lesser producer would have milked it for all it's worth, would milk all that drama for all it's worth. Like, trust me, if Puffy were producing She's Out of My Life, Puffy would have had the whole mark. He would have had Kleenex, like, sponsor the tour.
You had people talking about, well, what was he crying about? Who was he talking about? Is he talking about Brooke Shields? Is he talking about, what girl is he talking about? You know, is he still talking about Ben, that rat?
We had seen him out publicly with Stephanie Mills. We'd seen him out with Tatum O'Neal, with Maureen McCormick from the Brady Bunch.
Girls would get together and were like, I wonder who he's talking about. You know what I mean? And you would look at the Tiger Beat magazine to look for the gossip and everything. Who made Michael cry? That's how we took it. Not that I made Michael cry, because I would never make Michael cry.
She's Out of My Life is, in my opinion, one of the two songs on Off the Wall that there's nothing on Thriller that tops it.
Quiet Storm was huge in the 1970s, which was a kind of radio format of black music that celebrated intimacy and sensuality and ambient softness and quietude. Can't Help It was really the Quiet Storm demographic, right? It was really the kind of late night boudoir romance thing.
It's the first time that you really hear Michael sounding like, to me, sounding like an adult and sounding outside of his R&B thing. It's jazzy.
Suzie Green had started working on it. She was in the Supremes and had also sung with Stevie.
It could have fit on Songs in the Key of Life, really.
That was supposed to be one of the songs on Songs in the Key of Life.
Ooh.
See, I didn't know that. He had the I can't help it if I want it to the hook.
Yeah, I think she wrote a lot of the lyric when we actually were in the studio messing around with it.
And that's right.
Stevie Wonder plays the tune. Pharrell Williams, artist.
I Can't Help It is my favorite. Stevie overdid it with that song. The nature of the chords are very nocturnal. You know, it doesn't sound like a sunny day to me. It sounds like, you know, a beautiful paradise evening, you know, somewhere untainted by the humans, you know, mystical world, you know, unicorns walking past.
My sister Renee had been hearing me play this cassette. She and Michael were friends. And she took it over to let Michael hear it, and I think it was great that he did it. I mean, really, he did an incredible job.
The melodies are very seductive. They carry some of those signature Stevie lines, but also the signature Stevie chords.
I really believed in the album. I believe in Michael Jackson.
Stevie Wonder, I love Stevie Wonder.
And being with Stevie Wonder, being in his sessions, and just sitting in and learning, just is incredible.
You could put on I Can't Help It right now, and I'd still find something that I haven't heard, or it would remind me of something, or the warmth of the bass line would just be like, just kind of wash over you. It's just like, you don't get sick of that music.
I did a record back in 1977. We did It's the Falling in Love. We co-wrote it together, and I know you played on it.
Yeah.
I think my record served as a nice...
demo.
As a demo.
Patty Austin was a singer in the Quincy Jones arsenal. The very first time that I've heard Patty Austin's voice was It's the Falling in Love.
The thing that really steeps a record in its era and that can make it sound dated is relying heavily on very specific technology of the time. And in the 80s, it was very much about gated reverbs. In the late 70s, you had these like big, massive disco claps.
This album was perhaps maybe one false step away from being a very dated disco record.
Didn't have any of those like tricks or gimmicks. It was pretty much, even though it was immaculately arranged and all the percussive parts and all the way the parts work together, there's nothing other than a bunch of dudes playing the shit out of a song in a room. That will never date.
In a lot of ways, Off the Wall is probably the culmination of classic disco. It came out in August 1979. The Disco Sucks movement started just a month before in July, where Shock DJ Steve Dahl in Chicago gathered a lot of people together at Comiskey Park in Chicago to burn disco records, which was a really, I think, implicitly racist and kind of homophobic movement. People wanted to shift the dial of popular music back to where they felt comfortable. Right, which was not black, not gay, not Latino.
Burn This Disco Out actually might have been an apt title because it was coming literally at the end of the disco era, just at the edge of being a disco record, but moving the genre forward.
Far from one of the disco factory music that was just churning out factory beats.
You can feel that kind of visceral energy. I mean, Off the Wall really is like lightning in a bottle. I mean, you really capture Michael Jackson at 20 years old with all of that excitement and energy and passion, that still really comes through on that record.
This is the very last 8-track that my parents brought me before I stopped buying 8-tracks. I remember Off the Wall coming out the second week of August in 1979. Departure album is sort of an album that is in a person's canon in their career of which they make a 180 turn from what they were known from.
He was no longer the teeny bopper act. He was no longer the socially shy, awkward, maladjusted guy with acne. He was suddenly exuberant, confident. You look at the album cover of Off the Wall, it's like his prom picture. He's in a suit and tie and the kind of Frank Sinatra, Sammy Davis mold. Now he's this freewheeling playboy that you can imagine out on the streets of New York.
Again, life-changing. I think sophisticated. I think glamour. I think provocateur. I think everything that I wanted to be.
Oh, yeah. I'm interested in promotion. I want to do things that's never been done before. If it wasn't for promotion, who would know about the Jackson 5? Who would know that we exist? I wouldn't be able to translate my music to different countries. Africa, Japan, New Zealand, Scotland. all the way to Australia.
There's a universal core in music that I think transcends even what a crossover is about. Here we view a crossover as being, you know, black and white markets, you know, which we've been faced with for years. But I think Michael's thing went even past that, you know, when you get into Argentina and Israel and Spain and Scandinavia and Australia.
I tell people fashion and music is a universal language. Mm. Wherever you go, you're going to hear the same songs in certain countries. And when people come together for those songs, they're all happy. They're all at peace.
Because a lot of people don't even speak English when you travel the globe. Yeah. But they know the song, they know the music, and they know they learn the lyrics somehow. And that's just so wonderful how you can bring people together just through your music.
Michael Jackson can come out on stage and not say anything, and you know that he cared. 100,000 people in an Olympic Stadium feel that he's right there for them.
Everyone thinks, you know, like they've had such a personal connection with him, you know, but that's how great he was. He made you feel like that.
Michael just inspired me to be a better person.
I actually do believe that the blessing that the Lord gave this family, the musical blessing, the true mission behind all of that, I believe, is to unify the world together through your music as one. And it's about changing the world for a better place for our kids to grow up in.
He had seen what had happened to artists like James Brown, Little Richard, Jackie Wilson. Sometimes the industry wasn't fair to black artists.
I remember fighting in a meeting, you know, like, how come Michael's not on the cover of People magazine? How come he's not on the cover of Us?
Pop radio stations didn't want to play Off the Wall in the beginning.
Publicity lady would tell me, well, if a black person is put on the cover of these magazines, they won't sell.
Michael Jackson is a viable artist all by himself, and if they gave him the opportunity, he could win the radio stations over. And he did.
He just made us feel like this is where we are, is where we always were, and we weren't. There are kids that, like, were born when Obama was in office, so they don't understand a world where, like, there was a white president. They don't even know what that feels like. I didn't know what it felt like to not have, like, black pop artists, because he made us feel and believe that that was just the norm. He took black music to a place where it became human music.
Music has no color, and it shouldn't have color. And I don't believe in that. What I do, I don't want it labeled black or white. I want it labeled as music.
It was a simpler time, and radio had everything to do with it. Hey, let's go out with some up-tempo first, get ourselves positioned, bang, and we'll come in with that ballad, and, you know, you go gold, you go platinum.
Four singles in the top 10 in Billboard, not counting it being number one on R&B radio stations. It had never been done before.
Some people looked at it as a disco album, which in retrospect is kind of foolish because it's one of the most creatively influential albums in history.
You look back at the awards for Off the Wall, they're R&B awards.
The music industry is still very segregated at the time, and Michael was only nominated for R&B awards, and he won.
The Grammys presented Michael Jackson's Best Male R&B Vocal Performance Awards during the pre-broadcast segment of the show, while viewers were watching local programming and commercials.
Love is my message.
He thought it wasn't fair. He thought they snuffed him. It wasn't fair.
He came in and he told me, he said, Mother, next year, they're going to have to give it to me.
And that was Thriller, huh?
That's right.
Off the Wall really kind of set the blueprint for R&B, and I think most artists today acknowledge that.
It's hard to come up with something fresh and new all the time. They go back and they say, what was great? What was done that was just great? And they find themselves listening to Off the Wall. And then they take a little piece and they say, see how he did this? We got to do that. See how they made this sound? We got to do that. I do that, so I know.
That album, you hear it in music all the time. Pharrell to Justin Timberlake.
My music would not be here if it weren't for his influence. Off the Wall and the next album after that as well. Like, I wouldn't have music.
I don't think there's any other record that I played more music from, like, in the course of 20 years of DJing. 10 to 15,000 times, like, I have released the vinyl on those songs.
Off the Wall is the album I still play to this day. It's the album that I put on when I want to teach my daughter how to dance.
It was soul music's epoch of magic realism. And when I say magic realism, I mean it was transformative. It takes you someplace else.
It's so rich musically. The arrangements, the singing, the background vocals.
Michael taught me Melody's King. He was like, babies don't sing lyrics. They hum melody. A, B, C, D, E, F, G. They may not know all the letters in the alphabet, but they know that melody to that song.
That was the way I saw music. I always saw music as like these portals. It's like you listen to a song, okay, it's gonna take you into this land every time.
In its first year alone, that album sold over 6 million copies. It's been overshadowed because of the Thriller album.
There would be no Thriller without Off the Wall.
Everybody knows that.
When he went in the studio to make Thriller, he was intent on making the biggest album in history.
And the amazing thing is that he actually did.
Whatever your top game was, you going on top of that one. That was his gift.
You're dealing with a true artist devoted to the art, and everything else is secondary.
I think it's very easy for people to get sidetracked and talk about this complexion, and you know, focus on what this man was and how he was that, and how you can learn from that. You approach things the way he approached music, and you will be phenomenal.
And the idea of being separated from your brothers, does that hurt?
No, it doesn't. It, because there's other kinds of sounds of music that I love to do. It hurts what is inside of me, and it can't get out, and it's hidden from the world. But when I do those solo albums and I'm doing all kinds of different music, it's wonderful. I feel like I'm accomplishing what I'm supposed to do.
And you don't feel guilty or worried about your brothers?
No, because they understand. Why hide some? Why hide it? Share it.
Off the Wall will live forever. That was 1979, but this is just the beginning for that record. It's just the beginning, and new people will explore and discover it today and tomorrow, and it'll be something new to them today and tomorrow. It's just the beginning.
He transcended sexual barriers, racial barriers. He brought everybody, I mean, say everybody, and old people, young people, gays, straights. You, I mean, wherever you went, there was a smile.
But the beauty of his artistry and what he has left us with so much joy and, like, so much thankfulness for all that he had given to me, you know, given to everybody. But I mean, this is going to be selfish here for a moment. What he gave to me, and I'm glad that I found that joy again. And I think that in that way, his spirit is still with me.
He surpassed what I ever expected of him. I expected a great deal of him, and he surpassed that.
There's an element of God that's in people. Some people, God laid his hand on longer and held it there.
Secretly and privately, really deep within, there is a destiny. And just for me to stay on that track and follow it, I really believe and feel I'm here for a reason, and that's my job, you know, to perform for the people. And if they accept it, that I'm rewarded. They want to put me up on that pedestal. I feel even better.
Do you ever want to stop?
No, don't stop till you get enough.
And you haven't had enough?
No way. No way.
Don't stop till you get enough. Don't stop till you get enough.
Coming up, Live and Lovely, from Ella Fitzgerald through Motorhead to Jules, Bowie, Oasis, Beyonce and Adele. Pop goes BBC Two next.
BK Heart MJ, Brooklyn, New York, August 19th, 2009. An open-air celebration.
Say, get plenty of jackets at Dr. J's.
12-inch vinyl off the wall. Board and see my beast swim ball. Coney Island, Neverland, Red Hook, Mirror Man, Southside, Williamsburg, Dirty Diana, Ghetto Bird, Bed-Stuy, Afro, Jessified, Baby Bro.
Front and future, front and folk and wannabe started something. East New York, polo boosters, mama say, mama kusa.
Brooklyn, head to the hills, this is the way you make me feel. Flatbush, what y'all say?
Lick a shot for MJ.
He was his mother's son, he was his father's child. Claimed us his party people, moonwalked the world to our style. Never duplicated, never repeated. First to do gangster music videos, have you seen Beat It? See Michael and Eddie Murphy do remember the time. We love the second his eye, we love the plank and his struggle. We love the way he would show up to a black tie, then rockin' Robin his monkey bubbles. Enjoy yourself, enjoy yourself, enjoy yourself.